From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The coronavirus outbreak is ravaging rural America, and now it's taken a tragic turn in Kansas. Yesterday, the Norton County Health Department said that all 62 residents of a local nursing home have tested positive. 10 residents have died. Data from Johns Hopkins University show that as of Sunday, Norton County had the highest number of new per capita cases of any county in the U.S. Let's bring in Dr. Krutika Kupali, an infectious diseases physician at the Medical University of South Carolina. Doctor, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And of course, the details are still emerging about what's happening at this nursing home in Kansas. But as someone who specializes in treating vulnerable groups of people like this, what's your first thought about this case?
My first thought is that this is an incredibly tragic story. You know, we are now 10 months into this outbreak. We've known that elderly patients are at increased risk for contracting this disease. In the United States, over 250,000 cases in nursing homes have occurred across this country. Over 59,000 patients have died. And we really just need to be doing better. And at this point in the pandemic, I really think that we have the science, we have the information, we have the resources to be able to protect patients better, and we should be doing that.
When this pandemic first started, the outbreaks in nursing homes were huge news. As they happened, you know, that was the emergent storyline at the start of this thing. It seems like we haven't really heard about a case like this in a while. I mean, is that because they're slipping through the news cycle, or are we just getting better at preventing them?
Well, I think it probably is a little bit of both, right? So you're absolutely correct. At the beginning of the pandemic in the United States, this was the big storyline. And I think we learned from those stories on things that we needed to do to better protect our vulnerable patients. We needed to implement better infection control measures. We were doing better at segregating patients in nursing homes. We weren't allowing visitors and things like that. And so I think one of the questions we have is, how did this happen in Kansas? What types of things led to this outbreak? I think that will be very important to know as we move forward and look at this particular situation.
One patient is in the hospital being treated, but it appears that the others will be treated inside the nursing home itself. What's in store in the days ahead in terms of their treatment? Because as we know, these are presumably very fragile patients.
You know, one of the things that I don't think has been apparent yet is how many of these patients are asymptomatic, so don't have symptoms, how many of them are actually having symptoms. So that would be something we'd want to know. I think the other thing is, you know, we'll have to wait and see if some of them are in the early stages of disease, how they progress, and some of them may end up becoming hospitalized. And so they'll need to be watched carefully. And the understanding is that in Kansas, with cases surging, the hospitals are already at capacity. They are very full. Healthcare workers are already being stretched to the limits. And so this is a very concerning situation. And these are the things that all of us who are working in public health and infectious diseases are worried about. It's not just going to happen here in Kansas, but throughout the country as we head into the rest of the fall and the winter, as people have become more lax with their public health measures and we start seeing more cases, not just potentially nursing home facilities, but all over the country, hospitals are going to become fuller and they're going to reach their capacity.
And we're seeing that now in some places. But tell me more about what we have learned over the last couple of months about the protocol or best practices for keeping these outbreaks away from nursing homes.
Well, one of the things that has been very helpful in trying to keep outbreaks away from nursing homes is, you know, they've restricted visiting of friends, family members to residents. The other things that have been done have been improved infection prevention measures, right? So keeping patients distanced, wearing masks, good hygiene standards. Those are all things that are really important in preventing any infection, but particularly coronavirus. And then also, you know, you have healthcare workers coming in and working, and so making sure that they're, first of all, not coming in to work when they're sick. Second of all, having routine testing algorithms or routine infection control measures, again, for the healthcare workers, and making sure that they're also adhering to those measures. So things like wearing masks, good hand hygiene, all those things are really important in trying to prevent infections in these types of settings.
Well, this story out of Kansas is just a reminder, if anyone needed it, that the coronavirus pandemic is far from turning a corner, far from over. Dr. Krutika Kupali, an infectious diseases physician at the Medical University of South Carolina, thank you for your time and your insight today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, last night in a rally, President Trump mocked how much CNN was covering COVID-19. No one wants to hear it, he said. In response today, CNN is running all of the weeping, heartbreaking families who've lost loved ones to the disease. They've covered a very long montage at this point. Of course, both Trump and Biden are heading for their final debate on Thursday night. The Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates says candidates' microphones will be muted while their opponents deliver a two-minute statement before each of the six topics to try to counter the first debate when President Trump in particular ran a commentary under Joe Biden's words. On Fox today, Trump said he may or may not interrupt again. But what will he say? In the last 2 days, he's called America's Dr. Anthony Fauci an idiot, called Joe Biden a criminal. Joe Biden did call him a clown in the first debate. Let's put all this through the filter of history with Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, I want to start by listening to some sound that we have here. The president was in a conference call with campaign workers yesterday. He knew reporters were allowed to listen in. He is talking about Fauci. Let's listen.
Every time he goes on television, there's always a bomb. But there's a bigger bomb if you fire him. But Fauci's a disaster. I mean, this guy, if I listened to him, we'd have 500,000 deaths.
Now, the president also blasted government scientists, as we said, CNN. He called Joe Biden a criminal based on those emails Rudy Giuliani claims to have on a hard drive. You know, this is something the Republican Senate committee didn't find. Can you think of any other president speaking this way during a reelection campaign?
Not really. I mean, you do have moments when the rhetoric can get pretty rough. Certainly in 1972, I would think of when President Richard Nixon really went after George McGovern and presented him as virtually unpatriotic, despite his being someone who served in the war. But as with many things, President Trump is taking this to a whole new level. He's, you know, criminalizing his opponent, literally calling for investigations, and he's attacking his own scientist in the middle of a pandemic. So I think it's a important scale and scope difference, and very distinct to hear a president speak this way.
Well, we all know what happened to McGovern, you know. And so the question is, where should Joe Biden look in history for some direction? Now, here he is at a campaign rally in North Carolina on Monday, criticizing Trump's view of the pandemic.
The other night, Trump said at one of his rallies, "We've turned the corner." And my grandfather would say, "This guy's gone around the bend if he thinks we turned the corner."
Now, Julian, there's a campaign by Trump supporters like Fox News' Brit Hume and lawyer Rudy Giuliani to cast Biden as senile. Giuliani said on Fox and Friends that Biden had dementia and would get through the last debate with attention deficit disorder medications. I mean, he said that. Does Biden have an historical role model to follow to not get dragged into that mud?
He does, and he knows it very well. Barack Obama in 2008... who wasn't facing an incumbent. He was facing Senator McCain and Sarah Palin, whose campaign rhetoric was often a little like what we hear today. He stayed focused on the long term. He stayed focused on his big issues. He avoided getting kind of swept up by what's called the noise of every day in the coverage. And I think that Obama role model, which Biden was there to see firsthand, is exactly what he needs to do. He is winning in the polls. And the one thing he can't do is just react to everything that the president's throwing at him right now. Because in the end, people seem to like who Biden is and at this point what he stands for.
Well, but a huge number of Americans very much like Donald Trump and who he is. As an historian, are you already, you know, stitching this together, or does, you know, the book down the road, the future judgment, history, depend on what happens in the election? If he wins, does that alter your view of his language now?
It won't alter my view of his language. I think his language is very much what I just characterized. If you judge it by the norms of what we've had before and how presidents have acted, I think you can evaluate what this is and the effects that it has, certainly in the short term, and why it's dangerous to our democratic institutions to have this kind of presidential rhetoric normalized. What's its impact politically? I have no idea. And it will depend in the end on what happens, not just with this election, but elections in the years that follow and how our politics unfolds.
We have a few seconds left. I'm reaching back to Hoover as a president who, in that case, the Depression just kind of said, oh, it's going to go away and the market will fix everything. Can you think of anyone else in American history who has dismissed something as big as a pandemic?
Well, Woodrow Wilson didn't talk about it. He didn't dismiss it, but he, you know, hadn't talked about it. I think Hoover's the perfect analogy. He tried to wish a depression away. It didn't work. And he and his philosophy were discredited.
Yeah.
And that's very much what might happen this November.
Julian Zelizer, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
The Supreme Court will review two challenges to President Trump's policies to reduce migration across the southern border of the United States. One is the Remain in Mexico policy that forces migrants to wait in Mexico while their asylum claims are being processed. The other case is about wall funding and whether the Trump administration can divert $2.5 billion from Pentagon funding to pay for the construction of a wall along the border. Michel Marisco is senior editor for KJZZ's Fronteras Desk. He's based in Tucson, where he's been covering the border for years. Michel, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
And let's focus on that second one. Lower courts have ruled that the Trump administration can't use military funds to pay for the wall. But the Supreme Court let construction continue while the appeals process played out. Remind us what's at stake with this case.
Right. So there are 11 segments of the border wall that the military was going to be transferring money from to build. And the Trump administration, the president, actually declared an emergency last year in order to expedite that process. Those 11 segments in Arizona, California, Texas, we're all going to be using the Department of Defense money. And when the Sierra Club and the ACLU and the Southern Borders Communities Coalition all sued to stop it, they won in some courts, but there was never a stay. So while the Trump administration kept losing the cases, the construction just kept happening. And now it's almost finished.
Well, and the background here is that Congress wouldn't fund the border wall the way that President Trump needed it to in order to get this thing built. But how much of the wall has been completed since Trump's been in office?
They say that they've built 371 miles of border wall as of yesterday. For a little bit of context, a lot of that is replacing old vehicle barrier and border wall that was already in place. Very little of it is actually going up where nothing had ever been in place. So, for example, here in Arizona, they're going to be erecting by the end about 240 miles of border wall. And we already had about 195. So that just to give you a little bit of context of what's actually going up. Now, the wall that is going up is big. It is 30 feet high. It's got the giant anti-climbing platforms on the top. You know, it's massive compared to the border walls, the 18 foot high ones that the Obama administration had been erecting as of 2008.
How does that change if Donald Trump loses the election? I mean, what happens to the wall under a Biden administration?
You know, I spoke with lawyers from the ACLU about this just a few days ago. And the answer there is, so A, President Biden would end up in a really curious position as a defendant defending the wall put up by his predecessor. He has said that he would not build any more wall. However, he was very ambivalent. He didn't answer whether or not he would actually take it down. And so that raises a lot of questions about whether a Biden administration would actually do so. The ACLU has said, and the Southern Borders Communities Coalition have said, that they will sue to force the Biden administration to tear it down if it comes down to that.
KJZZ Fronteras Desk Senior Editor Michel Marisco speaking to us in Tucson. Michel, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Activists in Kansas City are stepping up their fight to stop evictions during the pandemic. They've sued in federal court, disrupted virtual eviction hearings, and chained themselves to a courthouse entrance. We'll hear from one of those activists in just a moment, but first we're joined by Gabby Diamond, a Kansas City resident who's facing eviction. Gabby, thanks for being here. I'm sure this is a difficult time for you.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, sure. And can you tell me a little bit about your situation and why your landlord's trying to evict you?
Well, my landlord rents her rooms out, so it's kind of like a shared environment. The other tenant in the house was deciding to start issues, and he wouldn't clean up after himself, and it was just an ongoing problem. And every time we would bring it up to the landlord, she would make it seem like it was mine and my fiance's fault. So we called Healthy Homes to get an inspection done because the house has bugs and rats and stuff like that. So it's just an unhealthy living environment.
Hmm. And how much are you paying in rent every month?
It is $600 a month, and that includes everything, only because I'm renting out a bedroom. Mm-hmm. We've actually been on time every month. My fiance is a vet, so our rent is paid religiously through a program called SSVF, which is a wonderful program.
And you were supposed to have your case heard last Thursday, but as I said, it was disrupted by these protests. I mean, what's your plan if that case does, or when that case does, move forward and you're ultimately evicted? Do you have some place to go?
No, not right now, but we are looking for somewhere to go. Because of COVID, it is harder to find places to go. Like, if we did want to go to a shelter or something, you know, they're kind of full because of COVID.
I see. Gabby, hang on just a moment, if you could. I want to bring in Tara Raghavir, who's the director of KC Tenants. It's the group that organized last week's protest. And Tara, I assume what Gabby's telling us here sounds familiar. We are in a moment where a pandemic has broken out. People don't necessarily have a place to go if they lose their homes. I mean, but what is the bigger picture that you're seeing in Kansas City? How many evictions like this are happening?
Gabby's story is absolutely familiar to me. There have been evictions in Kansas City, and specifically the county that Gabby and I both live in, Jackson County, since June of this summer. And, you know, KC Tenants had fought for an eviction moratorium that we won in March, but the presiding judge of our local county court failed to extend that moratorium. So evictions began back in June, and they've actually been happening in two ways. One, in person, in court, exposing people potentially to coronavirus. And then the second way the evictions have been happening is by teleconference. So people are actually being evicted from their homes by conference call. And that was what Gabby was experiencing last week, a conference call eviction hearing. And I think it's about 1,700 evictions that have been filed since June. And notably, about 700 of those have been filed since September 1st, when the CDC actually issued a nationwide eviction moratorium. So these evictions shouldn't be happening as a matter of public health, according to the CDC. But nonetheless, landlords across Kansas City are still evicting their tenants.
Let's get into that just a little bit. The CDC, as you say, issued an eviction moratorium earlier this year, meaning that you couldn't kick somebody out of their home through the end of 2020. Why isn't that protecting people like Gabby?
So there are a number of loopholes with the CDC policy that those of us who have studied these kinds of policies noticed within hours of the announcement on September 1st. One of those loopholes is that the CDC moratorium only protects tenants on rent-related evictions. It does not stop a landlord from doing what Gabby's landlord is doing, which is evicting Gabby for a reason which has nothing to do with the rent. And actually what we're starting to see is more and more landlords advising one another and getting advice from their attorneys to identify some of these non-rent-related reasons to evict and then move forward with the process that way, even if the main reason they're trying to evict is because of back-owed rent. So that's one of the loopholes. Another is that a tenant actually has to submit the form themselves. And what we found as we door knock across the city is that a lot of tenants have no idea that there is such a national ban on evictions. And then the third problem that's kind of particular to Kansas City is that our local court has actually issued their own guidance. And in many ways, it contradicts the CDC order itself, and it actually makes it easier for landlords to evict right now.
And so your group, KC Tenants, is trying to fight against this. And on Thursday, last Thursday, delayed more than 100 eviction proceedings by shutting down or disturbing the hearings as they were happening online. But what's the goal here, Tara? If these hearings can just be rescheduled and the evictions can be go forward, what are you trying to accomplish?
So I think it's important that while we think about these bigger numbers, 1,700 eviction filings, 600 in September, we have to remember that every single eviction is by itself an act of violence. So what we're trying to do right now is harm reduction, right? We're trying to keep people in their homes today, even if all we're doing is kind of delaying the inevitable. But I should say that tenants have been clear since March that an eviction moratorium alone was never going to save us. Since March, we've been advocating for rent and mortgage cancellation, both across the state of Missouri and nationally, right? And we should cancel the debt that's accruing in these months, even as evictions are or aren't occurring across the country.
Gabby Diamond, are you still there with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, let's bring you back into the conversation because you are living this. You are on the verge of potentially losing your place to live. What do you think should be done here to help people like you?
I just think we should stop evictions altogether. Like if it's not a serious reason for evicting people, and like the pricing on the houses and stuff is just so high, it's ridiculous to find a place.
And would you have to go to a shelter if you got kicked out?
Yes, if a shelter can take me. Like at this point, it's very hard to find shelters that'll take people because of COVID. Like they have zero beds and stuff, the ones I've called.
Yeah. That's Gabby Diamond, Kansas City resident facing eviction. We've also been speaking with Tara Ragavir, director of the group KC Tenants. Thanks for your time, both of you. And Gabby, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. stm.mit.edu.
If you've ever wanted to live in the big city, New York or San Francisco, now might be the time. As the pandemic keeps many Americans working from home, renters are moving out to areas where they can get more space. And that's driving down rents in some of America's most expensive cities. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, is on this. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
So this decline is really astounding. In San Francisco, the median rent for a studio apartment fell by 31% from a year ago. In New York, it's down 15%. This is according to a new report from Realtor.com. Besides maybe people looking for more space to have home offices, what's going on?
Yeah, in the icy parlance of the trading floor, this is demand destruction. So renters, they're fleeing high-density, high-cost zip codes that were on fire, we know, for the better part of a decade as the decade and tech and finance surged, that's now turned around. The irony, Robin, is that now the more comfortable you are in your job, the more freedom you have to work remotely and probably for a while. So why not get a bigger place in a less crowded town? And it's all internet connection right now.
Yeah, but you'd be leaving New York or San Francisco. But I'm hearing, too, that New York and isn't the way it was. So some, there's no theater. So that might be adding to this. But some of the steepest drops are in California, Silicon Valley, where, the tech workers aren't expected to go back to their offices. So how long was this expected to go on?
It's an existential question right now. You have tech giants now telling workers that it's okay to work from home at least halfway into 2021. So when does that experiment become normalcy? When, and this is critical, Robin, when are workers going to know that they can port their pay, their benefits, their standing for good to cheaper cities? I suspect that is going to be the next shoe that drops in this and that you're going to see a whole new round of cost cutting and rents go up in satellite cities.
Yeah, well, meantime, in Manhattan, the vacancy rate is at the highest level in more than a decade, and landlords are offering months of free rent to fill empty apartments. What else are they doing to try to get renters back?
As a longtime Manhattanite, I can tell you we haven't had that spirit there since maybe 1989. And it's not just rent concessions, but everything from laundry to utilities to newly partitioned gyms and Peloton discounts, faster broadband. Some are even venturing into subsidized delivery services. It's all in the name of making density economics, which after all is the hallmark of a Manhattan, work again, make sense again.
Yeah, well, this is having an effect elsewhere because as rents are, you know, going down in cities, they're rising in nearby communities and suburbs. What impact does that have on the housing market in those areas?
Well, the housing market's already on fire, thanks in large part to collapsing mortgage rates. But as more earners move into these secondary and tertiary cities, you get higher rents to support investment properties. So while Manhattan rents are hurting, rents in the Bronx, I mean, they're up about 9% from a year ago. If you look at Worcester, Mass versus Boston, or some of the areas in leafy Connecticut versus the big cities, hours down and up in New England and the Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, and what does that do? You said it leads to investments. I mean, people are buying. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you're going to see the investors come in and say, if there's something underlying, if there's a value, if rents are going up in this market, that not only are mortgages cheap, but people who have cash and can get mortgages can buy properties to rent out. So that gives extra lift to these secondary cities.
Oh, gosh, I just feel like maybe I could commute.
Come to Richmond, Robin. I'll have you in Richmond anytime.
Rents going down in cities. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
With voting season now well underway, we're following a number of tight Senate races around the country as part of our Here and Now Senate Tracker series. In deep red Mississippi, the Democratic candidate for Senate, Mike Espy, is far outraising the Republican incumbent, Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith. And political analysts say it could actually be a close race. Jeff Pender is senior political reporter at Mississippi Today. He's in Jackson. Jeff, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
And how remarkable is it that we're even having this conversation about a close Senate race in Mississippi 2 weeks out from Election Day? The state hasn't sent a Democrat to the Senate in more than 30 years.
That's correct. Yeah, of course it is 2020, so anything's possible. But Espy has been campaigning hard really ever since 2018, his defeat then. So, yeah, a lot of people are tuning into this race. A little bit of outside money coming in, and I guess some people waking up to the possibility of flipping a seat blue here.
All right, well, let's get to know the candidates just a little bit more. Cindy Hyde-Smith, of course, has the clear advantage of history on her side. As you say, it's a rematch. She got the job in 2018 in a special election to fill the seat of the retiring Senator Thad Cochran. Here's one of her campaign ads describing what she's done in Washington.
I haven't focused on the daily political drama of Washington, D.C. I focused on getting things done for you, like growing our economy with lower taxes, reducing regulations, and helping farmers and small businesses bounce back during these uncertain economic times.
What is Senator Hyde-Smith's record in the Senate, and what's she running on in 2020?
She's running on in 2020, two words could probably sum it up, Donald Trump.
really?
He remains very popular in Mississippi. He obviously in 2018 helped her greatly, made several campaign stops here for her. And she, I believe, feels like she's sitting on a lead based on how Mississippi votes in presidential elections, and trying to hang on to that lead and not do anything that's going to rock the boat or endanger it.
Her opponent, Mike Espy, former congressman, former Secretary of Agriculture under President Clinton, and he spoke about his record in a recent ad. Let's listen.
I passed laws with Republicans like Thad Cochran and President Reagan to bring good jobs here. And as Secretary of Agriculture, I opened markets for Mississippi all around the world.
Now, Espy would be the first black senator from Mississippi since Reconstruction. If he wins, what kind of case is he making to voters?
His major issue is health care, which is always a huge issue in Mississippi, poor state, lacking access and affordability. And he's been campaigning hard, and he's got to put together a coalition of black and white voters. He's got to really get the black voter turnout. Last time he ended up 32.5% with that turnout, and he's got to get it up to at least 35%. He appears to be doing pretty well with female voters, and that includes white female voters, and some of his most recent advertising is targeting that demographic, obviously.
Well, the numbers show that he's also far outraised Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, which
yes.
is interesting that he's beating out a Republican incumbent in this race. But what, you know, what are the, what's the realistic chance that Mike Espy becomes Senator Espy in Mississippi?
That's, you know, a lot of unknowns in this race and in this time. COVID-19, what's that going to do with turnout? But it is possible. You know, Mississippi has an African-American population, voting age population of around 37%. He's pretty assured of winning most of that vote. The campaign finance you mentioned, he has shattered many records in Mississippi recently. He, for this last quarter, outraised Hyde-Smith 4-1, more than 4-1. He wow. He raised $4 million. She raised $815,000. Converting that to votes is another thing, but that is huge.
Can't hurt. Jeff Pender, senior political reporter at Mississippi Today. Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
And with the U.S. election underway during a pandemic, healthcare workers and medical students are urging their colleagues to go out and vote. Veronica Zaragovia from member station WLRN in Miami reports.
Vishnu Mupala and Yumiko Nakamura raced against each other in a recent statewide competition among medical schools in Florida.
I don't want to say UF has a pretty solid lead.
But... Do they? I feel like there's a technical issue in Florida Atlantic University.
Mupala and Nakamura are fourth-year medical students. He studies at Florida Atlantic in Boca Raton, and she's at the University of Florida in Gainesville. They were registering voters using a QR code. It's like a barcode for smartphones.
If I won, it's a really big deal, yeah. And I'm going to make a big deal about it. But if I didn't win, then like, maybe
lose,
it's just
then
for fun.
It's just for fun.
But their goal is serious. Nakamura says the right to vote is as important for public health as having access to healthy food or medical care.
The people who are the most disempowered in terms of their health, maybe who have a disability or are suffering from mental health issues, they're the ones that are least represented. And that's important because health policies at the end of the day tend to impact that group of people more.
The medical students' voter registration drive is part of a national campaign called Vote Health 2020. It's run by health professionals who want more patients and healthcare workers to vote. A 2007 study published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine suggests the voting rate for health professionals is below the general population.
If they're planning on voting on election day, but they are in the hospital, well, who's going to hold the pager or who's going to make sure the medical student or the resident or the fellow is able to go vote?
That's Sarah Nia Lair. She's a non-practicing doctor and founder of Vote Health 2020. On its website, people could check their registration status or download resources to motivate people to vote safely, like flyers with drawings of voters wearing masks, using hand sanitizer, and distancing from others. Healthcare providers can also request a 5-minute presentation that two doctors give to staff by phone, for example, on how to get patients and peers to vote safely.
It is making sure that everybody has the right and the ability to vote, and in the context of a pandemic especially, but always, that they have a right to vote and they can do so as safely as possible.
Another doctor started a similar effort called patient voting that helps hospitalized persons get emergency ballots. Many of these projects are nonpartisan, but some doctors say they're disappointed with how Republican leaders have handled the COVID-19 pandemic.
You need to vote like your health is at risk because it is in this election.
Dr. Mona Mongit is an allergist and immunologist in St. Petersburg, Florida, and a member of the National Committee to Protect Medicare, a health advocacy organization that has endorsed Joe Biden.
So I'm doing everything I can to ensure that my patients vote, that my community understands how to vote safely. I would like anyone to reach out to your trusted doctor, whoever that might be, to create a voting plan.
Healthcare unions are also working to get out the vote. Melissa Greer works in the dietary department at a South Florida hospital. She's a member of Florida's largest healthcare union, the 1199 SEIU, which has endorsed Joe Biden.
Well, I don't just see it on television. I actually live it because I work in the hospital. I have seen the suffering of COVID-19.
She's motivating voters through phone banking and canvassing.
Make sure you go and vote because we can't change anything without doing the work to change it.
Jason Morales is the Union South Florida political coordinator. He says from now until Election Day, members will ramp up efforts in English and Spanish, homing in on cities with many Black and Latino voters.
Just because of the high density of Black and brown voters that we're trying to get out. But that doesn't mean that that's just our focus. We're also talking to everyone under the sun who's a registered voter to make sure that they go out and get out the vote.
Morales is Latino, and he says many of the union's members are people of color, and many of them work in healthcare. He says many of these workers feel like politicians haven't done much to help them. The only way to change that, he says, is to vote. For Here and Now, I'm Veronica Saragovia in Miami.
The Department of Justice, along with 11 states, filed its long-awaited antitrust case against Google today, the first of what could be a cascade of antitrust cases against big tech companies from the federal government. The case is also likely to make some strange bedfellows. Attorney General William Barr and Senator Elizabeth Warren, anyone? Peter Kafka is senior correspondent at Recode. And Peter, we knew this was coming. Attorney General Barr has been eager to get this antitrust case against Google filed. The president and supporters like Barr are furious at platforms they see as anti-conservative. We'll take that up. But Barr was so eager, a few of his lawyers left earlier this summer. They thought he was rushing it. So tell us, what's at the heart of this case, the government saying Google is a monopoly?
So the heart of this case for now, and it may change over time, this is the initial foray, is the government saying, look, Google is a monopoly because it has bought itself pole position in search by specifically on mobile devices that they're mostly focused on here, by paying Apple and other device makers billions of dollars a year to be sort of the dominant search engine, and sometimes literally sort of locking competitors out. And that's the main thrust of their argument for now.
We know that the DOJ was pursuing two issues, one focusing on that Google controls 90% of all searches, but another avenue focusing on the fact that Google captures one out of every three online advertising dollars. So do we know which they're going to be focusing on?
I think they're going to try to throw as much at Google as they can. They're starting with search. That's the primary focus. You dominate the search ad market by dominating search. So one comes directly from the next.
Yeah. Well, typically consumer harm is the golden standard for these kinds of cases. If you're a monopoly, maybe you're hurting the consumer in some way. Is there any indication from the DOJ filing that they're going to say Google is doing that?
They are saying Google is doing that. It's going to be, I think, a little harder to make that case because Google's a free product. And Google's argument, by the way, the money we're spending goes to other phone makers that makes it cheaper for consumers to buy that phone, where we're actually helping consumers out. The DOJ, can I read from their complaint to you? By restricting competition in general search services, Google's conduct has harmed consumers by reducing the quality of search services, lessening choice in general search services, and impeding innovation. So saying because Google has a monopoly, it's hurting its competitors, which eventually is going to hurt consumers by giving them less choice and less good product.
Right. So they're very well aware that they have to make that case. Well, and Google is expected to fight back in part by arguing what we mentioned, that the Trump administration, they are going to say, is politicizing the issue. They just want to get back at big tech for what they believe is an anti-conservative bias in big tech. Do you think that that's what's happening here?
Well, Google will certainly argue that. And you can see all sorts of indications outside of the courtroom and outside of the complaint that there might be political animus here. That said, Bill Barr has not done a victory dance today publicly. Donald Trump has not said a word about this. And the DOJ's lawyers today said, look, there is a discussion about whether there's a conservative bias and whether a piece of legislation called Section 230 should be rewritten. But we're not talking about that. That's a different set of things, and that's going to be handled by Congress. We're not talking about that. So they are being very clear that they're separating that from any political discussion. And whether that does or doesn't hold up in court is something we're going to find out.
Well, and then there's that Elizabeth Warren part. A lot of smart people on both sides of the aisle including Senator Warren, have been beating the antitrust drum against Google. So just quickly, if the government is successful in arguing its case that Google behaves as a monopoly, what happens? Does it get broken up?
That could be that will be the question, whether they'll want sort of a structural change, saying, all right, Google, we're going to separate your search business from your Android phone business, and we're going to make you break them up and run them as two different businesses, or sell one of them. You know, by the way, this case is going to drag on for years. And one argument is that just the filing of the case and forcing Google to have to defend itself and sort of keep its eye, take its eye off the ball, could also be punishment. That's sort of the argument we've seen from people at Microsoft who faced the last major antitrust suit filed in 1998, which took 6 years. They said, we right. missed basically the mobile business because we were too busy fighting the DOJ.
Right. And so that may be the goal here as well, just take them off their game. But if Google prevails, what happens to the landscape?
You might argue nothing else happens. You know, this, you know, there's been a lot of talk about antitrust reform, but this lawsuit, because it is a lawsuit, it's the thing that's actually happening, and it's sort of now locked in process, sort of regardless of who wins the election, most likely, is the one tangible effort we're going to see from the government. We're guaranteed to see from the government to sort of rein in a big tech company. We just have not seen, like, we have not seen one of those in this era of technology.
Well, and as we said, it will have bipartisan support, so we'll keep an eye on it. With Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode. Peter, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll follow that story for 6 years. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.